This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Next week, the Texas legislature is set to reconvene, and public school education funding has already been targeted as a must-fix for the lawmakers. That means different things to different people. Some want that to mean cutting property taxes. Others want that to mean that the state will put more money into public school education, maybe get that from the Rainy Day Fund, and others are going to be looking at outcomes for education, particularly for the low-income and children of color, and that's the majority of Texas school children. If the state is the state failing these children, and does Texas essentially have two different public school systems, one for the poor, Black and Hispanic, and the other for the wealthy who tend to be white? The Texas Tribune took a deep look into the issues with a special series called Disintegration. We're going to be talking about that this hour, and you can call in. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And you could also email with your questions and comments to The Source at tpr.org. Tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this hour with Alia Swaby. She's a public education reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alexa Ura is the demographics reporter for the Texas Tribune. Also with us is Pedro Martinez, superintendent for the San Antonio Independent School District, where his school district was a part of the series that was examined, and Al Kaufman, a professor at St. Mary's University School of Law, and he was also the lead lawyer in Edgewood versus Kirby, an expert on the public education funding as much as anyone can be these days. Welcome to The Source, all of y'all.
Pleasure being here.
Thank you, Dave.
Alia, public education reporter for the Texas Tribune. Great series, huge depth. Y'all probably put a lot of miles traveling around Texas looking at the different school districts. What was the germ of the idea? What was the seed of an idea?
Hi. Yeah, so I think that, we both started this knowing that we don't really talk about segregation anymore, but that you can see that it still has lingering effects on Texas schools. You can still see that there are more than 1 million Black and Hispanic students who study in Texas classrooms that don't have, you know, any white students in it. And so we started trying to see, what should we be talking about in terms of modern segregation in Texas schools? And where are the regions of the state where we should be talking about this now moving forward, especially, you know, as you mentioned, as lawmakers try and decide where to put more money and who needs that money most.
And Alexa, you look at demographics. You're the demographics reporter for the Texas Tribune. What are the demographics for public education students in Texas?
For a couple of years now, Hispanic students have made up a majority of public school students. It's at about 52% now. Black students make up almost 13, while white students make up just 28%. Obviously, a massive shift from decades ago, and really from when some of these districts were first created. And in a lot of the places that we focused on, it was the Hispanic community that had seen the most growth, and, you know, sort of a trend across the state where you are now dealing with public school students that come from very different backgrounds and very different learning and have very different learning needs than they did before.
And Alia, as you looked at the school districts that y'all probed, you went to Longview and Richardson. And Longview in East Texas, Richardson in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and here in San Antonio as well. Y'all took a really deep look in San Antonio. Why is that?
So we looked at North and East Texas primarily because those are the areas that have seen a lot of demographic growth since Brown versus Board of Ed in the 50s, and definitely since Texas actually started desegregating its schools in 1970. And so those were clear places where, you know, the demographics had changed. There were more Hispanic students. They're facing challenges that are more recent than potentially other parts of the state that haven't seen, Hispanic students form a larger percentage of their student population. And then in San Antonio, I think for a couple of reasons, we focused on it. Because Edgewood ISD has been, the plaintiff in a lot of lawsuits against the state over the school finance system for decades. That's a clear example of a school district where, they've argued that they've been underfunded since the beginning, that they were created as socioeconomic segregation that has continued to this day. And I think that's been an important thread through our project is the ways that race and class sort of play a role at the same time really affect how students are learning and which students are getting more resources. And then San Antonio ISD ended up being a story where we focused on a school district that is really doing a lot to try and deal with some of these issues and dealing with it in a really modern, innovative way, but also there are challenges partly because of other factors such as, housing segregation and factors that are outside of school districts' control that still contribute to certain students having more than other students.
So, Alexa, as a demographics reporter, I mentioned in your stories about San Antonio about how economically segregated the city is. And can you elaborate on that, particularly along the school district lines?
Yeah, San Antonio has this vast history of segregation, particularly when it comes to income. When it was first created, it's much more fractured than so many of the urban cities. And in reality, you had these school districts that were created to be unequal because you had folks in wealthier areas with mostly white students at the time who drew their lines to very intentionally to keep that sort of population. This has changed over time as the Hispanic population has grown even more so in a city like San Antonio, which has almost always been majority Hispanic. But you have these areas of the city that are, completely different worlds and are just miles away from one another, particularly when it comes to the resources that those schools have. It's a history of sort of consolidation of school districts merged with some of the racist housing segregation that existed decades ago. And the combination of that today has led to the system in which you have children attending school in the same city, but experiencing very different educational trajectories.
Well, speaking of different educational trajectories, I mean, this was a really ambitious program, Aaliyah, and you could have gone on forever. There's so many different issues and topics regards to things that are challenges that are confronting certain school districts. So what are the top challenges overall looking at the state?
So I think, a key factor in looking at this now and the ramifications of segregation now are really the disparities between Black and Hispanic students and then white students. And so, our last story that focused on Edgewood ISD, which, as I said, has been, historically poorer in terms of property values and also, a lot of their students also come from lower income families, the realities for them are really different than the realities for, the school districts that have more wealth.
Okay.
And so I think that, we've looked at this in terms of the achievement gap and what that means for the future of the state.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue talking about Texas education. We're going to bring in our other guest, Pedro Martinez, superintendent for SAISD, and Al Kaufman, professor at St. Mary's School of Law. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about our school systems here in Texas. School systems are the entire school system of the state. The TEA governs that, but it's made up of school districts, and Texas has a lot of them, and San Antonio has a lot of them. Al Kaufman, professor at St. Mary's University School of Law. Can you tell me why San Antonio has so many school districts?
Well, they came from a bunch of small community districts, and as a county like San Antonio had 40 or 50 different school districts, and through the years, there was a county education board that began to consolidate them, and it was done based on politics and a lot of racial politics. Edgewood was created basically as a Mexican district, and the southwestern districts were created that way also. So you had that situation. I often say that Moses didn't come down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments and the school districts. This was ultimately a Texas legislative function. The Constitution gives the legislature the authority to draw the districts, and the legislature could decide to have county school districts if it wanted. But it left it to these local politics, which ended up hurting the poor and the minority groups.
And then some school districts had a property base, a tax base of high property value, and others didn't.
And there was a relationship.
Or don't. Continue
well,
don't.
They still don't. And there was then, and there still is, a relationship where the heavily minority districts are also the low property wealth districts. And that has been around in Texas since the districts began. And it really created the present school finance system. It was based on an understanding that the low property wealth districts were mainly, if not all, Latino.
So the school districts that we have today, that we enjoy today, are basically a political construct from mainly, the 50s?
They started in the 30s and 40s, really, up through the 50s and 60s. But the 30s and 40s were the main times of the combination of them. And it happened statewide.
But they were basically put together before Brown v. Board.
Oh, yes. They were put together before Brown v. Board of Education. Yes. Okay. And that was in 1954. And, of course, that's what declared that you couldn't discriminate on the basis of race in school districts.
Ending separate but so-called equal.
It ended separate but equal, but I went to schools in Galveston that were segregated until 1965.
And so some schools were very active in fighting against Brown v. Board of Education. Sometimes they did symbolic gestures like naming schools after Confederate generals like Robert E. Lee and things like that. That was not done out of patriotism to the Old South. It was done as sort of a middle finger to the Supreme Court at the time. And Aaliyah Swaby, you're the public education reporter for the Texas Tribune, and you write about how in Longview, they're very much still living with the legacy of trying to not be crazy about the Brown v. Board of Education.
I think in Longview ISD, the remnant of Brown v. Board of Ed and segregation is pretty concrete. They were under a desegregation order, a federal desegregation order, until very recently. There's an association with the legacy of segregation that's pretty visible in their school district, and I think that it's hard for a lot of people to talk about. It's a lot hard for people to talk about the racist past of the school district, but it's definitely still present in a lot of ways.
And Alexa Ura, as the demographics reporter for the Texas Tribune, I mean, is it a correlation? I don't know if there's a causation with the growth of minority students in the public school system and the reduction in how much the state of Texas is willing to pay for public education coming from Austin?
I think if you talk to a lot of folks who for decades have been fighting for equity for students of color, it's a sort of a data point that's hard to ignore, that as students of color have become a majority in our public schools, there has been a drop in support for those public schools is what you often hear. And I think in reporting this out, we talked to folks from all over the state. And one of the things we heard that was that one of the fallouts of integration was the white flight that came with it and the loss of political capital that public schools and public school students, who were mostly students of color, ended up losing.
And when you talk about, there's also a flight of students from the public school system to charter schools, Aaliyah, and you've been reporting on that.
Yeah, I think it's mostly, white students are leaving mainly for private schools, and then for, the school districts that are wealthier and suburban districts, or in the case of Longview, not necessarily suburban, but the surrounding school districts. If you look at the demographics of Longview versus those districts, Longview has a lot more Black and Hispanic kids than those school districts do, and that's not an accident. Those students left for the surrounding school districts that also, have more wealth than Longview ISD does in a lot of ways.
But say Texas has gone through a lot of demographic changes over the last 50 years, and so we're seeing that in our schools. So Pedro Martinez, superintendent for San Antonio Independent School District, you're dealing with students who are leaving the school district roles and going to charter schools, right?
That's right, Dave. I will say this, though. Yes, you know, I started almost 4 years ago, and our district had an enrollment of about 52,000. Right now we're at 48,700. So we've lost a little over 3,000 students. I will tell you, though, my colleagues all around me have also lost, on a percentage basis, at least that amount, if not more. And in fact, you know, Northeast and Northside, who are two suburban districts who have much higher wealth, Northeast took a significant enrollment drop last year, and Northside, their growth now has slowed down significantly. And I predict over the next 2 years, you're going to see them have enrollment declines. The challenge with charter schools really has affected the entire county. In my district alone, we have over 13,000 charter seats that are outside of us, with another 800 to 1,000 growing this year. With that, though, what our response has been really been in two front. One is we need to improve all of our schools. This is not, you know, one of the things that we cannot fight is when parents feel that our schools are not providing the right service to their children. That's something that we have to ensure that parents feel that we are providing that service. And second, we also need to provided more options. Families were looking for different choices. We now have single gender schools. We have more international baccalaureate programs. We have Montessori school. And so those have been also part of our strategy as well. They both have to work, though, and that's the challenge. And Dave, you mentioned that earlier. We're in a state that is in the bottom 40 to 50 states of funding nationwide, with over 60% of the children statewide that are now qualified for free and reduced lunch. In my district, when you put us, Edgewood, and South Sand together, we have over 80% of the families who have a median income of under $20,000 a year. And of course, I have the largest number because we're just so much bigger. And so those are challenges that are part of the segregation issue within a state that doesn't give us sufficient resources. But with that, I'll tell you, I'm more optimistic now than ever. Last year was our best academic year ever. We are now going to be able to show that we're now either outperforming or performing at an equal level to any of the charter schools around our area, as well as even schools in the wealthier districts that have mostly high poverty kids.
The phone number to call in if you want to join our conversation about the future of education, education funding, and closing the achievement gap, the number is 210-614-8980. Dave is on the line. And Dave, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
How's it going?
Oh, great.
I after my dad passed away about 4 years ago, I did substitute teaching in Northeast and Alamo Heights. And for another 2 years, I subbed in the SAISD. And never in my life have I seen such child abuse. These schools are channeling Hispanic and Black kids into menial service jobs, or they're suspending them. The little white kids at Alamo Heights, where I graduated, I tried to teach a graduating senior one day how to do long division with a piece of paper and a pencil, and he couldn't do it. He literally could not rattle off his times tables. He couldn't tell you how many nines were in 63 off the top of his head. I spent about 5 weeks at Nimitz, where my little brother went to junior high. It's about 98% Hispanic. When my brother was there, it was 98% white. But now the Hispanic kids, I mean, they treat those poor kids like prisoners. They don't know the difference between running a school and running a jail. And it's the same thing in the SAISD. At Jefferson, I spent a year and a half, and I watched some of these teachers over there kick kids out of class because they had the wrong color socks on.
All right, Dave. So how do we begin with that? So let's go to Pedro Martinez, superintendent for SAISD.
So one of the things that in our district...
Does that ever happen? You kick kids out of school for running out of the classroom for wrong colored socks?
Not that I'm familiar with, but I do know, Dave, that over the last 3 years, we've made significant improvements in addressing issues like discipline and ensuring that more of our children have access to better classes. Historically, I think we know there's been a history not only in our district, but statewide, where high poverty children have not been able to do well. And how do I know that? Statewide, only 6% of our children are college ready on the SAT if they're eligible for free and reduced lunch. We are now at 11% in our district, nowhere where we need to be, but almost double the state average. That's statewide. So whether you look at Northside or Northeast or Alamo Heights, or you look at any district across the state, only 6%. By the way, that number barely budged over the last 30 years. So we know that we can do better by our high poverty kids. And then we know that most of those children are going to be children of color, or they're going to be children that live in rural districts. So this is, again, goes back to the issue of investment in our schools, ensuring that these children have a shot.
So reporter Aliyah Swaby at the Texas Tribune, you can hear the Dave's call, a lot of passion there, a lot of frustration. Is that reflective across the state?
I think that, you know, when you talk about disparities between Black and Hispanic students and white students, you can see some of that play out in the data when you look at discipline and suspension numbers. Definitely across the state, you know, Black students are way more likely to be suspended and removed from class, and that's definitely a predictor for whether or not students will drop out in the future. As Superintendent Martinez says, you see statewide Black and Hispanic kids who are not ready for college, who are not passing state tests in math and reading. I think that there's a lot of frustration around the fact that, you know, in a now majority Hispanic school district, Hispanic students are among the students who are, you know, falling behind and not able to have the same resources and then the same outcomes as white students.
But Al Kaufman, you've been working on education funding for a long time, and as a professor of law at St. Mary's University, you know, we expect schools to educate these kids, but not everyone can really be clear on what that means. What is the education of these children? Some of them is behavioral, you know, instruction, and the other is, you know, we want them to be able to get to 5 R's or how many R's there are, you know, but they got to conquer these milestones. I mean,
well, schools are important. They're public institutions, and they must accept all students. So they have to deal with all of society's problems. And I want to make sure we continue, though, to focus some on the Texas State Legislature. I mean, you talked about the early case of Brown v. Board of Education. After that came out, the Texas governor and the Texas Education Agency head said, we're not going to follow this. We're not going to desegregate. They fought it for 10 or 15 years. In the school finance issue, the Supreme Court decided in 73 that it's not a federal issue, but the state dropped the ball and didn't do it. I will say the state is spending somewhat more money now than they did 10 or 20 years ago, but they're not nearly keeping up with the national
figures.
Overall figure. As a percentage, the state's decreasing its rank among the other states in terms of what it's spending. And given the needs of the state, it's way underspending. This is a state with a much higher than average number of poor people, English language learners, all sorts of issues that come up with these families, and the state's not keeping track. Now, I'm not saying that local districts have no responsibility or local principals. They all do. We all do. But the fact is the state has not provided the resources to these districts to really deal with these issues, and it does cost money.
Right. And so the question is where the money comes from. We know there's $13 billion expected to be in the rainy day fund. Is that something that the Texas lawmakers can look to try to shore up how much money is going to be going into the Texas public education system at the end of this legislative session? Education and politics, they cross over quite a bit, particularly in Austin. We're talking about what's the future of Texas education, how are we going to make sure that we're able to find the resources to close the achievement gap, be able to get children of color prepared for upper education and at an equal level. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We've got a lot of calls on the board. We'll get you on the air right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, looking at disintegration. It was a series that was a focus on the Texas Tribune, looking at school districts across Texas, some of the issues that they have with racial integration, also with the achievement gap that we have in the state. There is a focus on which this achievement gap, it reflects on how many Black and Hispanic students are not as prepared for college as many white students, and why is that? What can be done to fix it? Can these solutions be found quickly enough? Because there are a lot of, you know, we're talking about, you know, you're going to get to go through seventh grade once, supposedly, and you want to get everything that you can out of that time that you're in that desk. Let's go to a clip that we have from David Garza. He's a teacher and a parent at De Zavala Elementary.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to get kids to intermingle. it's neat to be able to say that, you know, you can go to somebody's house, you know, and you could hang out and you see a whole other world. I mean, that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. I just don't really agree with the way that it's been done. For instance, like I said, if you're allocating so many funds to these boutique schools and then you've got other schools that are just, you know, we're not getting those funds, that just doesn't seem right to me.
And that is from reporting that was done with the Texas Tribune. Aaliyah Swaby is the reporter for that. And so what was he talking about?
So I think San Antonio ISD has done a lot since Superintendent Martinez got there in order to try and turn around a lot of schools and also try and socioeconomically integrate the schools. So to get, you know, students of all incomes in the same classrooms and make sure that schools that are also going to be, you know, are schools with a lot of kids who come from poor backgrounds are also going to get the resources that they need. I think that in practice, some of the challenge of it has been, you know, limited resources. I think this school district has been really innovative in taking advantage of different state and federal opportunities and private opportunities to get funding. But also, you know, it's not possible to turn around every single school at the same time to the same extent. And so I think that there's some feeling in the community, in part from the teachers union, but also from you know, parents who are unaffiliated with the teachers union, that there are schools that are being left out of the process, while certain schools are getting more focus and more funding.
So boutique schools, Superintendent Pedro Martinez is with us. Do you have boutique schools?
I wouldn't say we have boutique schools. We've created new options for families. And so part of our challenge is that we're on two paths that are coming together. One is we're going through a significant turnaround effort district-wide. If you would have looked at us back when I first starting in the 15-16 school year, we would have had 35,000 out of 52,000 students in what they call improvement required campuses. These are campuses that would have been in the lowest 5% ranked in the state. We've now reduced that number from 35,000 to 8,000. 8,000 is still too many, but we're down from 35,000. We now, for the first time, we can show data that we're outperforming charter schools and other schools that have similar demographics as ours. That wasn't possible before, Dave. Our new schools, what we're trying to do there is we're trying to fight off charter schools who have been aggressively expanding in our county, not just in San Antonio ISD, promising families that they're going to provide them better options. And we're showing that, no, that if we're given a chance and we are using philanthropy, we are using state resources, that we can provide those options as well. The challenge is that not having enough resources to do it fast enough. You know, our schools just require a lot more resources. But I will tell you what's interesting is that when you look at the trajectory that we're on, our neighborhood schools right now, are going to outpace and outgrow, you know, our schools in the area. And I think and we're going to be able to show data to parents that showing that our neighborhood schools are actually the schools where they want to be. And so where their children should be. And so for us, it just takes time. It really is a function of time. This is my fourth year. The district didn't get like this overnight. It took a couple of decades, as you had talked about the history of San Antonio. But I feel we're in the right path.
Here's another clip from the Texas Tribune reporting. This is Brian Sparks, principal of Lamar Elementary and Bowden Academy. And here's here.
This school got a grant to help sort of jumpstart some of the work at the campus, which is really cool, that they wouldn't have otherwise had access to. So when I first started working in schools, I was like, it needs to be equal for everyone, and like everyone needs to have a fair shot. And the more I'm doing this, and like you kind of do it like one school at a time kind of thing, instead of doing it like for 90 schools all at the same time, it's just not sustainable or doable. So even though like that feels a little messier and like not as fair sometimes to like the schools that aren't getting the resources, like that's the way to get access to more resources, is to do it like to have proof points along the way and devote resources towards those schools and then build it out over time. It kind of makes sense. But whenever you're in the middle of it and you're not at one of those schools, it's sort of not very comfortable.
this seems like we're talking about winners and losers. And sometimes your kid's going to go to a school that's been deemed a winner. It's going to get all these resources. But if your kid is going to a different school and doesn't have all those resources, then if you don't get a superstar like Brian Sparks as your principal, then is your child going to end up with an inferior education? And I'm going to give Pedro Martinez a chance to respond to that. But first, I want to hear from the reporter on the story. Aliyah Swaby, is that essentially what we're looking at?
Yeah, I think that's the debate here, and I think I'm sure Superintendent Martinez wouldn't say that there are schools that are losers, but I do think that there are parents and teachers that we talked to who felt like they just weren't getting as much, and that they weren't necessarily on track to get as much in the future, that they weren't sure if the changes that have happened at a school like Lamar or the changes that are likely going to happen at a school like Bowdoin would ever come to them, especially since, students spend a certain amount of time at a school. If that doesn't come to you as a parent while your kid is in that school, then you've sort of missed that opportunity to get the most out of a school district where you see kids at other schools getting more, getting a massive turnaround.
So, Superintendent Pedro Martinez.
Sure. So first of all, I do agree that there's not enough resources for all the schools. It's my biggest frustration. It is the fight that we must take on with the state. At the same time, we're not going to make excuses. Right now, in our current bond that the voters passed in 2016, all of our comprehensive high schools are getting completely renovated. Every classroom will be a 21st century classroom with technology.
Many smart boards, all that stuff.
Smart boards, devices. We just got a grant to put in dark fiber across our entire district, so we'll be able to have unlimited speed, and we'll be able to give access to our families through our buses because all of our buses have Wi-Fi. So, Dave, for us, these are challenges that are real. These are challenges, unfortunately, because we're in a state that's underfunded. But I'll tell you, when you look at our results last year, we saw gains at scale for the first time in 10 years. Over 70% of our campuses showed improvements. We have a record graduation rate of 85%. We have more kids than ever that are college ready. Still not where we want to be. So for me, what I see is overall, the direction is very positive. We still have a lot of work to do. I have 40 buildings out of my 90 schools, 40 schools that have not been touched in 20 years. The internet was invented just a little bit before that. And these schools have never been touched. And we're talking about issues of heating and AC, especially in the summertime, when San Antonio goes over 100 degrees.
But you got the bonds, so that's fixed.
So what's happening, Dave, is with this bond, we're going to cover all of our comprehensive high schools, which have the majority of our kids in terms of high school students. The next bond, which we'll be able to do without raising taxes, we'll be able to start addressing those 40 buildings. Okay. And even before that, we've already started changing the AC systems for some of those 40 buildings.
Let me get Derek on the air. He's been waiting for a while. Here. And Derek, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, sir.
I want to say that I've lived 45 years, and my life's journey has been this story through public school systems. My parents actually moved to a white school district so that we would have opportunities that weren't in the predominantly black school district in Michigan. I've lived in New Jersey, North Carolina, Florida. I've seen this play out everywhere throughout the country. I know there are states like New Jersey that have Abbott school districts where they take money and redistribute it to the poorer school districts. It provides for nice, shiny facilities, but the scores don't go up. I know there's states like Maryland where they have countywide school districts where the drain on the available funds is much lower because there's fewer superintendents and overhead that is being wasted mm-hmm. for high-paid positions as opposed to going into the classrooms. This issue is not going to be solved until the legislature in Texas, in Michigan, everywhere, decides that there needs to be a central funding and that the price per student, regardless of where they live, is the same.
All right. Thank you, Derek. So Al Kaufman, what is the price per student for educating students in Texas?
Well, right now, I think the average is around $10,000, but all of the figures in the latest litigation were that it needs to be at least $1,000 to $2,000 per student more in order for Texas just to be able to compete with other states. And this money is for things like, you know, up-to-date technology, improving school buildings, building better curriculum, hiring the best teachers, keeping the best teachers, all very important. So Texas is behind. Right now, the legislature
has never actually assigned a dollar figure to how much it wants to spend on per student for education.
Well, it says what it wants to spend, but it's never said what needs to be spent, and it refuses to do that study. In the litigation, the experts came in, and everyone agreed that Texas needs to spend significantly more to meet their own constitutional standards, but the legislature doesn't want to do that study. The thing is, the legislature wants to keep state taxes down and has put more and more of the burden on the local taxpayers.
And we have certain rules, like we can't have a state property tax and Robin Hood and all those other things.
Still have the discretion to do it if they want to.
All right, so we're going to take a break. Got a lot more calls here talking about public education, who's going to fund it, what's going to happen in the next legislative session, who's going to pay the price if we don't get it right. 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about education in Texas. Who's doing it right? Let's go to our reporters. This is Aliyah Swabe. She is a public education reporter for the Texas Tribune. What's happening that's encouraging that you're looking at in Texas education?
I think as we move forward into a new legislative session that starts next week, lawmakers are pretty much on the same page that they want to address school finance in some way. I think that's encouraging for some, and maybe, you know, others are a little bit skeptical about it given, past inaction on lawmakers' parts, even after promising to make major changes. I think that, you know, the real conversation will be, what does school finance reform actually entail for different political factions, and who will win that argument? Will it be enough to actually make the changes that are necessary to improve the public education system?
And Alexa Ura, a demographics reporter at the Texas Tribune, you break it down in the stories that who's going to pay for it, and it seems like we're asking older, whiter Texans to pay for the education for the younger children of color.
Yeah, I mean, the changing demographics of the state have meant that our public school systems look incredibly different to what our taxpayer electorate might look like. And the growth of the Hispanic population in particular has been transformative for public schools. But I think if, you know, the future of the state has always been linked to the success of those public school students. And right now we're at a crucial moment as Hispanics have become a majority and are facing sort of these vast educational gaps that if the state doesn't do a better job of educating those children and ensuring that they're ready to compete in this sort of booming workforce that we have, we could end up curtailing some of those economic booms that we've been enjoying for the last couple of years.
So look at it as an investment in these children, make them able to generate more wealth throughout their entire lifetime so that they can support the tax base that Texas will need in the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, for decades, demographers and other leaders have warned lawmakers that there's a direct line between the state's economic engine and the education of its youngest, mostly Hispanic students. And if you look at the numbers, those are the students that are in the majority and are now facing huge gaps.
Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980, and Mike. And hi, Mike. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, sir. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is money really the answer? So we're fortunate to be in a property-wealthy district, but with recapture, we send so much money to the state that we have a situation where we don't have teachers in the classroom that we need, for example, reading interventions at a local elementary school. So my question is, that extra money that the Robin Hood districts are getting, are they using that for extra teachers? Because that's what makes a difference is teachers. Or are they using that money for better buses for their sports teams, new uniforms, cleats every year, and that sort of stuff, the things that we don't get.
All right, great question. Let me go to Pedro Martinez, superintendent for SAISD, to get his answer.
It's a great question. So first of all, when a district pays money to recapture, that money doesn't go back to education. Most of that money goes into the state coffers, and they have unrestricted use of that money. In fact, recapture revenues plus, in addition, for example, my district pays back, gets reductions in state revenue for every dollar of property taxes that go up in my local community. So all those revenues now have become the third largest funding source for the state. And they're very dependent on it. They use it to balance the budget. So sadly, none of that money goes to school districts. So the challenge really is that they have to raise the overall pot. So in other words, the way to reduce recapture, if they just start increasing the per pupil funding from $10,000, the national average is over $12,000, then districts will be spending less or giving back less to recapture. What we're also advocating for is also to target more of these resources to children with higher needs.
So if the money was dedicated to education and going towards school districts that are property poor from recapture, would that change things?
So sadly, the way the Texas laws work, the schools have to get equal funding. That's the challenge. So there's no way for the state to give more funding to one school district versus another. They give a little bit more money for high poverty children, but not enough. A little bit more money for English language learners with special needs, not enough. So really for us, what we've been advocating for is recognize that the $10,000 per student, which is what everybody gets, is too low. We need to elevate that to a national average of $12,000 and also have some additional resources for children that live in poverty, for children with special needs, for children that are English language learners.
Okay, so I just want to know, can the conclusion that I draw from what you told me about those recapture dollars going into the general fund, are those dollars going to education or are they going to tax breaks for refineries?
They're going into the general pot that the legislature can use for anything, because our education funding has not risen significantly, even though recapture dollars have gone up dramatically.
All right, another caller. Let's go to Tiffany. Hi, Tiffany. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to thank Superintendent Martinez for all the different choices and raising academic rigor for students. My daughter used to go to a Northside suburban school, and although she had made friends there, she just wasn't really being challenged, and we had to move for work. We moved downtown. I was really worried about, I heard a lot of, negative things about the district, but found myself really excited and surprised. My kid's thriving. She's challenged. She comes home and has really interesting discussions about politics, current events, humanities. We couldn't be happier making the move. And so I'm just super grateful as a parent to have had that option.
Thank you for that call. So Aaliyah Swaby, you write about this in your Texas Tribune article, and you document that there are people coming from other school districts into SAISD to take advantage of some of these specialty schools that have been created, right?
Yes. And we, Alexa and I, during our reporting, heard that same sentiment a lot from parents who, have more options for school districts. They probably live in wealthier school districts, more likely to be middle class, and they, are now choosing to come to school in San Antonio ISD the way that they might not have, before some of these options had popped up. So I think, that's definitely something that Superintendent Martinez, I know, looks at as a major coup, a major achievement that he's had happen in the past few years. I think the struggle then is when you get to some of the schools where parents don't feel like there's as much attention, is how does that affect students at those schools? And is there sort of a back and forth, a push and pull between, focusing on attracting parents from wealthier backgrounds, and then your focus on actually doing more for kids who are low income, who don't really have a choice in the same way about which schools that they go to.
And also, Aaliyah, you write about how some school districts are challenged by their school boards. Edgewood, which got written about, they're just regaining their autonomy after having to deal with state oversight. We have other local school districts that are challenged as well with dysfunctional school boards. How much of a difference does that make in what happens in the classroom?
Yeah, school boards have a lot of power, actually a lot more power than you would think if you saw who participates in those elections. You know, there are often elections that not that many people vote in, but also if you want, changes to be made in the priorities of a school district, then you have to look at the school board and who's on it and, what sorts of initiatives they're trying to get the school district to fund. So I think, we looked at it in the sense of the elections for school boards and voting rights. Of if you have a system where it's harder for candidates of color to get elected, then it's going to result in different outcomes for the school district.
And so, Al Kaufman, you want to reply to that?
Yes, that's true that the board do have a good amount of power. Most of the real nitty-gritty, though, is still set by the state. But the school districts and the school district administrations have a great amount of power, and there has been a lack of interest in it, I admit. But remember, some of these districts that have had these problems have been ones where there's so much pressure because of their low test scores and potentially non-performing schools that they just haven't been able to quite react to it and function with it. And while other districts don't have those challenges, I just want to say one more thing. The idea of the integration, some people see it as some sort of negative. The fact is there's a real body of research showing that it's actually good for both white kids and minority kids to go to school together, that when they do go to school together, everybody is benefited, as well as our general society is benefited. So let's not forget that it's a goal to be sought.
And Alexa Ura, with the demographics that you look at for the Texas Tribune, how much integration is there in Texas, or are we seeing a return to segregation, but mainly along economic lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we move forward, a lot of the conversation around equity in schools is along economically disadvantaged students and whether they are getting the same opportunities. But I think it's, you can't, in a state like Texas, you can't separate poverty and income disparities from race. And so at the end of the day, if you have students who are economically disadvantaged facing these vast educational gaps, those students are more likely to be Hispanic and Black. And so it's the sort of thing where you can't really ignore one or focus on race versus income and sort of expect any real change without accepting that those two things go hand in hand in a state like Texas.
And that is the future of Texas, a more racially diverse state. And if we don't educate everyone equally, or at least put in the effort, who knows what kind of state we will have at the end of the day. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us this afternoon. Aaliyah Swabish and Alexa Udov with the Texas Tribune, Pedro Martinez, SAISD Superintendent, Al Kaufman, Professor at St. Mary's School of Law. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.